It is the 10th of March. I still have to get the audio recordings updated and uploaded, but as of this evening, all of the PowerPoints to date are now on the TWIN page, as are a set of license agreements that are part of the work that we're going to be doing this week and are there, generally speaking, for you to use for reference. So what we're going to begin tonight and then discuss on Wednesday night, the first of the intermediate skills, fulfill those requirements, taking what we've learned so far and beginning to put it into, you'll pardon the expression, practice. Before I get to that, though, once our little world's slowest and now unsupported computer, Windows XP is officially unsupported now. So if you're running Windows XP, well, you wouldn't be because you wouldn't. Know that they're not pushing out any more updates for security issues. And yes, we're working on it here, but for now, at least, hopefully. There we go. Hopefully this will be, the computer won't explode or, God forbid, something. So I want to talk about some real-world licensing issues that have come up both very recently and then into the past to set the stage for thinking about the particular fact patterns, the particular issues that I'm going to ask you to do at least some initial drafting. Now, what I'm going to hand out for you near the end of class is a fact pattern. And what I'm going to ask you to do between now and midday, late-ish afternoon, Wednesday. I'm not asking you to draft, and it does say that in the syllabus, so I'm not asking you to draft an entire license agreement yet. We'll get there. What I want to ask, have you do is draft the key license provisions, or at least the significant ones. That so we're talking about the license provisions, the payments, and the warranties that go back and forth, and then some of the other things. And everyone's going to take a different perspective on this. I'm not giving you a lot of structure, and I'm suggesting you look really at any source for it, but let me get into that in a bit. So I saw this, I think it was yesterday, on Facebook, and it really caught my attention, and I decided to bring it to class. So first of all, does anyone know who David Gerrold is? Really? Okay, I'm not really surprised. David Gerrold is a science fiction and television writer. Among other things, he invented the Tribble. So if you've ever seen anything with Star Trek, those little furry ball things that you feed and they he made them up. And he's been writing, and he's a bit of a curmudgeon, and he'll tell you that. If you've ever seen the movie or heard of the movie The Martian Child, it wasn't a very, very popular movie, but it was based on a short story that he wrote. Anyway, so here's David Gerrold. And the context of this remark is the new Amtrak Writer in Residence program. If you have any friends who are writers, maybe you've heard about this. After apparently a challenge from a writer on Twitter to Amtrak saying, you know, Amtrak, if you let me ride your train, I'll write some cool stuff. So apparently Amtrak did and now has formalized it, and writers are asked to submit. It's essentially a fellowship, but the fellowship is they get paid in train travel. And it's fiction writers and nonfiction writers, all sorts of things. And I'd heard about it, and I had a couple of writer friends who said they were submitting, and then I saw this. Dear Amtrak, Yes, I submitted an application, but unless you change your rules, I cannot be a part of your writer-in-residence program. And I'm advising all other writers to withdraw as well. Here's the reason why. Grant of rights. In submitting an application, applicant hereby grants sponsor the absolute worldwide and irrevocable right to use, modify, publish, publicly display, distribute, and copy applicant's application in whole or in part for any purpose, including but not limited to advertising and marketing, and to sublicense such rights to any third parties. And then he says that the difference between him and a Rottweiler is a Rottweiler eventually lets go. So the first thought you have is, so what? This is a marketing thing. Why would anyone care that one is licensing, because that's what this is, right? It's a written license grant. You're licensing rights to use your application. So what? They want to say, you know, the story, you know, here's what this person said. You've seen these. But I wanted to show you why this writer and other writers are so concerned, and how you, in practice, counseling your client, need to consider that what they are asking for may... Oh, stop that. Leave me alone. It's not up to me. Seriously? Oh, for gosh sakes. All right, I guess I have to tell you the story because we're still on Windows XP in an old version of the browser, and I don't have the rights to update it. So, as part of the application, Amtrak requires applicants to submit a story. A piece of writing, up to 10 pages. Think of your law school applications, or your college applications back in the day, your personal statement, right? But here, give us a sample of your writing. Not unreasonable. They're going to be promoting themselves, giving away a trip, I don't know where, to a writer. They want to make sure that this person can actually write. Not unreasonable, except, think about this. Anyone see a problem with the writer granting the sponsor the absolute worldwide and irrevocable right to use, modify, publish, publicly display, distribute, and copy applicant's application in whole or in part? What's got Mr. Gerald so exercised?
He's giving away ownership of the copyright to any copyrightable works, and he's also...
No, he's not.
There's no
transfer of ownership here.
I'm sorry?
There's no transfer of ownership.
Really?
It's a license. Read what it says. Hereby grants sponsor the absolute worldwide and irrevocable right to use, modify, publish, publicly display, distribute, and copy. It's a right to use. This is a license. So it's not about ownership.
Okay.
Careful reading, right? But... So that's not the issue, but what might be the issue then? Even assuming, granted, it's a license. What do you think?
Americans intertwine with exclusive rights, like a copyright. You know, like,
well, those are part of rights, so why?
The modification, because it's like you're twisting the words and the person sending their application to the internet.
Well, what we have to remember is the application's not the problem. What's he concerned about? It's not the application.
Irrevocable?
Yes, but notice how he ends it. You may not have my firstborn or any other of my children. What's going on here?
Maybe he's already, something that he was submitting in his application, he already licensed to someone else.
Part of it is that. He's a writer. He makes his money having people pay him to distribute his writing. So a couple of things. One, well, a few things. One, modify. He may not want their editorial changes. Firstborn, right? This is his baby. These are his babies. Two, 10 pages, you write short stories, that's a significant amount of work. And either he has to write it on spec, meaning he writes it for this purpose, in which case he probably can't sell it, or he's already published it somewhere else, in which case he may not have the rights to do this. Because if he's, you know, he's sold it to Fantasy and Science Fiction or some other magazine or some sort of collection, the pre-existing license, or maybe he sold the copyright, I don't know how he works, could make this a problem. In the same way that if it's a nonfiction writer who's someone who, let's say, writes for Time Magazine as an employee, the writer says, here's my writing sample. The writer may not have the rights to grant because they belong to Time Inc. as an employee, right? So, one, this is rather insensitive because it is an extremely broad grabbing of rights without, this is not if you win, then, right? There's no transaction here. I'm not even sure what the consideration is. So enforceability is another story, but this is not, we've agreed to publish you or we've agreed to give you a train ride. And so as part of it, you let us publish your story or whatever. We may have to edit it to fit. No, every single person who submits an application is granting this license to Amtrak. And assuming that every single person has the right to do that, Amtrak has just obtained a huge amount of right, a huge license. Let's say they get 1,000 applications. They can publish a book. They can sell a book. Well, yeah, but they could do that anyway. If you ride on a train, what?
By that contract, you make it acceptable. They can't.
Take a look at the back of your Amtrak ticket sometime, or your credit card agreement. That ship has sailed. That ship has sailed. This is not about collecting personally identifiable information for marketing purposes. Maybe it's a small part, but even there, you'd have to look to Amtrak's privacy policy to see what it says. And I would show it to you, but of course I can't get to any part of Amtrak's website apparently. But think about this. If you wanted, right, to come up with a free way of getting all sorts of content to publish, couldn't do much better than this. Is that Amtrak's intention? No. I shouldn't say no, because we looked at the 23andMe, right? And I would think this is more lawyers being careful about how they're going to be using this for marketing purposes and not considering that their audience is going to be reading this provision, apparently, after the fact. Notice this says, doesn't say, I was considering applying. No, he applied first, then he looked at it, or somebody told him about it. Right?
Sounds like they just got a lot of material for the magazine.
Don't you think? They now have years of stuff for that on-train magazine or anything else. Take all the science fiction writers, put them into a collection, sell it. You've got the rights to do it. Is this enforceable? I would be concerned because where's the consideration? What does the writer get for it? What?
Free
free tickets, right? The winner gets free tickets. That's why this is just submitting an application. I'm not sure what the consideration is, but we're not even there. The point I'm trying to make here is as much a strategic one. It's a, because Amtrak has pissed off a whole bunch of people who are really good at expressing their anger in writing and have a built-in audience. This is not good PR. And it's the kind of not good PR that probably stems from a lawyer who didn't think it through. We have to be sensitive to our clients' business needs. I don't think Amtrak needs bad anything. They do badly enough on their own. You know, they're never financially stable. I think other than the Northeast Corridor, they operate at a loss everywhere. I rode the Acela. I got train sick trying to do actual work because the tracks are not meant for that speed. It was smoother on the slower train. But anyway, no, they don't need this. Nobody needs this. Another one of my favorite licensing stories. Again, strategy. Strategy. This comes back to 1989. There were 3 daycare centers in Disney World. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say that. 3 daycare centers in Hallandale, Florida. Where is Hallandale, Florida? Anybody know Florida? Is it? So it's, all right, here's our map. Oh, look, it actually works, sort of. Okay, yeah, so, okay, so here is, so good. So you do know Florida, all right. Well, there you go. So northeast of, so it's north of Miami Beach, right? There we go. So this is North Beach, not South, very North Beach, not South Beach. Okay. All right, and not a near distance from Orlando, but yet. When the officials, what was the story here? The Walt Disney Company discovered that 3 daycare centers in Hallandale, Florida, had unlicensed Disney character murals on the outside. And so, what did the Walt Disney Company do? Cease and desist letters. At which point, what did Universal do? They got their Hanna-Barbera professional artist, shipped them out to Hallandale, and had them paint professional murals on these daycare centers and got written up in the New York Times. What a great PR opportunity. What a great PR opportunity. Why would Disney do this? Why would Disney send cease and desist letters to 3 daycare centers? From the looking at this, close to 100 miles from Orlando, from the Disney parks. Why would Disney do this? Why? Why would Disney?
Maybe teachers start beating the children.
That's what I think, right? On the one hand, you say, it's Mickey Mouse, right? It's, I don't know which characters it was. Clearly there are copyrights that they have and trademarks, but why would one make the difference and not the other? It does,
trademark,
by the way.
You have to enforce in order to keep it.
Granted, yeah. But they were not branding. This was not a trademark use. I'll show you what kind of use this was. Maybe. Work. Work. My old friend Strongbad. Oh, it's working. I know, a lot of this is, you have, if you don't know the characters. Yes, it does look like Pikachu. I don't... Homestar Runner, everyone. Yay. Okay. So, why would Disney send the cease and desist letter? Because, as you say, just imagine if one of these daycare centers turned out to be the home of some sort of child abuse scandal. You know? Mickey's a rat, etc., etc. why would the daycare centers put pictures of the cheat or Mickey Mouse? I wish I could have the picture. My son, who my oldest, who was the Strong Bad fan and who gets this stuff. We were walking through.
Is that on TV?
No. Homestar Runner, we'll talk about Homestar when I'm not pushing for time. Great, early, very influential web series, all done in Flash. Anyway, so we were actually walking through Astoria, Queens not that long ago. We walked past the daycare center, and there were all these cartoon characters, and he says, oh, look, unlicensed characters. So I have a picture somewhere. But anyway, why would the daycare centers risk the wrath of the mouse? It seems to. And why Disney? Well, they are in Florida. And even if they're 100 miles away, Disney is Florida and Florida is Disney. And they don't think, right? Every preschool has, I shouldn't say every preschool, I'm sure there's, and I'm probably the one across by, I would bet, actually, does anybody know? The preschool next to the federal and state courthouse, they have any unlicensed characters painted on the outside? That would be a really, next time anyone, you're driving by, take a look. I'm really curious. But you know this happens. Where my wife works, they had a whole, it's a special ed preschool, and they had painted this nice alphabet across the walls. And, you know, C was for cat, and he had a hat. And, you know, it was like, they do this all the time. Because it resonates. It resonates with their population. And they don't think, I need a license. All I need is someone who can paint halfway decently. But of course, they're wrong. But you have to think about this, right? You think about Amtrak, you think about this. Yes, as a general matter, from a trademark perspective and a patent perspective, there is an obligation to enforce. Because otherwise you can lose the right to enforce. But would this really be a trademark violation? If they didn't call themselves, you know, Disney Daycare, that would be a problem. But if they just had the images like every other preschool, is that a trademark issue? Even if the characters themselves are used as trademarks by the Walt Disney Corporation? What do you think? But even if they are, they're not using the marks in any sort of, yes, they're on the wall, but it's not, if it's not the name and it's not in the marketing material, it's just decoration.
Right. I was just curious, and I looked up the crime rates in Allendale, and they're the sixth unsafest place in Florida.
But what were they in August of 1989 is the real relevant question. Obviously, and who's committing all those crimes? The poor kids who went to the Fred Flintstone decorated daycare center. They've grown up, right? 25, yeah, that's right. It's my college 25th reunion. So now they're, you know, in their late 20s. They're either the victims of the crimes or the crime bosses there in Allendale. So, again, think not just like a lawyer. You think like a lawyer, you do this and you do this. What's your client trying to do? What's the purpose? What's the purpose? Love Strong Bad. Anyway, so let's take a look at this. The fact pattern here, not particularly imaginative, I'll save that for the final. The fact pattern here is a typical one in a lot of ways. Here you do have someone who wants to license cartoon characters for commercial purposes. Someone in another industry, not in daycare, but here, a manufacturer of breakfast cereals and snack bars. Why? Well, you know that it's true, because if you've ever gone shopping, even VeggieTales has snacks for it. Now, that's not one of the big properties. I don't know if you know what a VeggieTales is, but it's cartoons and really sort of odd computer animation of Bible tales and moral tales starring vegetables. It's better than it sounds. But in any event, you could see VeggieTales fruit snacks in the supermarket. I was stunned that someone bothered to find the VeggieTales people and license them. But look at the cereal aisle. Look at the snack bar aisle. This cartoon character and that cartoon character, and I don't just mean the ones that started on the cereal, like Captain Crunch. But, well, what is the classic, longest-standing cartoon character relationship with cereal? What? Right? Pebbles! Hey, Bon! The fake Fred voice. What are you doing with my pebbles? For some reason, people always try to steal cereal in commercials. Birds, bunnies, I don't know, whatever it is. Right? Pebbles. Flintstones. Flintstones is an interesting case. Because what were the Flintstones characters advertising when the Flintstones characters were actually on the air live? Anyone ever see the Flintstones Winston commercial? Help if I can. Oh, yeah, it would help if I could spell. These are legit. These are not some sort of a spoof. So these are actually the opening credits, or the closing credits, maybe. Let's go to here. I will save you. No, this was right. Well, it was not part of the cart. You've never seen the Flintstones? They don't generally smoke, no. But when they first aired, it brought to you by, and it was right there. It's essentially product placement. Brought to you by Winston. See, right there. Now, this, I suspect, strikes some of you as very odd. Remember, who was the audience for the Flintstones in 1962, 64? It was not a children's show. No, it was primetime spoof of the Honeymooners, the same way that The Simpsons is not a children's show. The Flintstones were the Simpsons of their era. We don't think about it because, you know, at least some of us grew up watching it on syndication and whatever during kid time hours, but they're not made for kids. And so, you know, it's not all that far-fetched.
Did it hit both levels, though? Whereas, like, The Simpsons, if you watch it as a kid, it's fun, entertaining, funny, but it's also got a level to it.
You know, I don't know. It's really hard to judge, but it was a prime-time show. So it wasn't targeted at kids. The problems they were, you know, all the jokes they were there, it wasn't really kidsy. I mean, some of it was. But that, first of all, I suspect even the idea of cigarette ads, I'm old enough that I can vaguely remember them when we still had cigarette ads on TV. But none of you is. But that you have cartoons. And this was not controversial. If this were, you know, if The Simpsons were on there, Homer and Marge would be lighting up with Winston's. Probably Bart would too, but you know, he's Bart. Pebbles was a little young. So that was the brand that wanted to be associated with this cartoon then. Who wants to be associated with the Flintstones now? Well, we have cereal for decades. What else? Anyone know what other major products? Some of you may have grown up with them. Flintstones vitamins. As if they tasted good. Every vitamin has that same icky vitamin taste, right? Did you?
They also had like popsicles or push pops.
Yeah, they're all over the place. I suspect they're a little bit less popular now because kids wouldn't know who they were except from the, oh look, the cereal people are on the vitamins. So manufacture, and why is it that the vitamins company and the cereal company and the push pops company, you know, if you go to see the generic ice cream truck, they have, actually we have them downstairs too sometimes, but if you see like the little character pops that they have with the disgusting gumdrop eyeballs that leak color, but they have Pokemon and they have Spider-Man and, you know, the whole, why do they do this? Because they can, the kids say, I want, I want, I want. Right? Kids don't want all brand. Well, not normal kids don't want all brand. They want Flintstones. They want Pokemon. They want whatever. I mean, you know, next week it'll be Grumpy Cat does have a product. Cat Pacino. There's a coffee there. I think there are some cat products, and I'm pretty sure there's Grumpy Cat coffee. I love Grumpy Cat, but that's another story. So, okay. So let's say you are the manufacturer. That's the fact pattern here. Put yourselves in the role. Let's just sort of talk this through. What I'm going to ask you to do, let's talk through the issues now. And then send you off and just respond to these. And as it says at the bottom, please do email me your samples, because I want to be able to show them. And please just don't name them license assignment, because I'll get 12 of those and I have no idea who's or who. So put your name in the file name, please. It's a good idea for resumes and it's a good idea for this. So let's start from the other side. Let's leave aside for a minute the product manufacturer. I think I'd shown you the SpongeBob DVD player. Let's leave your client aside. Put yourselves in the business shoes of the licensors of Hanna-Barbera. Excuse me. Maybe not at the Winston era, because they were not licensing out, they were soliciting advertisements. They were soliciting sponsorship money. That was the money to pay to run the show. So it wasn't really a license per se. And if anything, Winston was licensing their brand to the producers of the Flintstones. But put yourself in the mindset of the owner, well, Disney, because certainly Disney does license to other manufacturers, or Hanna-Barbera, or whoever, United Plankton, who owns SpongeBob. what concerns, what would the licensors want from a relationship like one of these? What are their key issues? What does a licensor want from a license? Well, let's start with that. What does it? Why is a licensor licensing anything? Money. So there's got to be value in it. The deal has to make sense. So how can, isn't it all additional money? If Hanna-Barbera is not in the breakfast cereal manufacturing business, and I don't think it is, isn't any amount of money it gets from, who is, I guess it's Post, for making the cereal? It's free money from their perspective. They don't have to hire animators. They don't have to, you know, do any of that stuff. How do they judge the value, what they should be getting? It's all free money. How do you judge the what they should? How do they judge what they should be getting? How do they? What's their metric?
Cost of the industry.
Okay, so one is, what's typical? How does what's typical? You know. You have to be careful, by the way. Why do you have to be careful about typical in the industry pricing? Why do airlines and gasoline companies have to be careful in this country about pricing the way other people price? Anybody know? Antitrust. We're going to talk about antitrust a little later in the semester. So you have to be a little bit careful. Because if you're all charging the same amount, it's rarely a coincidence. So yeah, there's a certain amount of, but every character set's going to have a certain amount of value, every manufacturer. So how does your, if you're representing, putting not this, but putting yourself, your in-house counsel to Cartoon Character Company of America, and they are approached, your client is approached by a potential licensee. What, how does your client decide, maybe this is the first in a new product, how does your client decide if the money is right? This is not complicated legal stuff. So it's not just, that's a really good point. It's not just about the money. Especially if you're talking about a current product. If you're talking the Flintstones already, they're not, you know, unless John Goodman and Rosie O'Donnell come back again for the, or whoever did it the second one, because they didn't come back. There are actually live action Flintstones movies. The first one was pretty good. Take a look for that one. That's a good one. It's John Goodman and Rosie O'Donnell, and they did. And Rick Moranis, I think, was Barney. That's right. Halle Berry was. And they even got the voice of Harley Carman to do the bird. We had been the Great Gazoo. But anyway, yes, I am totally, totally over TV'd. But let's talk about current things. What benefit does the producer of a movie? A current movie. You're going to see Sherman and Mr. Peabody products. What benefit, besides simply the license fees, do they get? They get advertising out of it. Absolutely. Absolutely. They are putting their brand in a market that isn't about the movie, but it is going to further cement their brand, their film, so that when people want to come back and see it again, or people want to go buy it on DVD, it's still top of mind. So your client, and certainly the other side, there's this balance. One factor is, how much money, how much profit will the licensee be getting at all? If the licensee is making a dollar per item and the licensor wants to charge 99 cents per item or $1 per item or whatever, that deal's not going to happen. So the licensor says, we'd like to get some money. We have to understand realistically what the potential profits are coming out of this deal so that we can then strike an arrangement that's fair to both sides. We get something out of it as the licensor. Some of that value is cash. Some of that value may be in advertising. A lot of times, companies, we see product placement, they're not paid to put their products in. They pay to put their products in. It benefits them. It's why almost every television show has computers that look like that, because Apple has been a leader in this. Except for iCarly. They don't have to cover it.
Most TV shows, they end up covering.
Have you looked at a sitcom lately?
Big Bang Theory is covered.
Do you know why it's not? It's covered? Because Apple's not paying them.
Right?
Or iCarly used Pear computers and Pear phones because they were just making a spoof. But look at how many Apple computers you see. Or sometimes it's just really, really pathetic. Some mid-season of Smallville, Toyota was sponsoring. It was the Yaris. And so they'd have the characters, let me just get into my Yaris and I'll be over there. It was really that bad. Or they had that gum, that sort of trendy chewing gum in the black boxes, whatever it is that I don't even know. But there was one episode where that gum was sponsoring a concert. You know, there are people with superpowers, but somehow they're driving Yarises. How many friends do you know who say, you know what, I'll be right over in my Yaris? So sometimes it's a little bit awkward. Apple does a better job of, you know, I mean, you know what I'm talking about.
But I feel that, I mean, if I'm Apple, I'm not really paying, because if you want a trendy computer in your show, and somebody puts this in, even with other people know what it is.
I'm sorry. I don't buy it. I don't, because... I'm trusting you on this one.
Game of Two and a Half Men.
Yeah, but, you know, it may just be that they got them for free, but they didn't get paid enough to put the brands on there. Take a look, every lawyer show, why do they look so authentic? Look at the bookshelves. I don't know if it's still true, because every lawyer show, certainly of the last 30 years, the bookshelves were filled with current West products. Just look at the background. Law and Order, it's just, right?
I saw it in How I Met Your Mother in the earlier seasons when he was in law school.
Yeah.
And they had the current books on the desk every time they were in the apartment.
Right. So it's not just Apple, it's West. If you get unfortunate enough to have to watch the Curious George movie, I don't recommend it. But it was a harmless cartoon movie. It wasn't as bad as some of the ones my kids made me see. But I like some of them, not this one. But what really offended me was in this otherwise generic world, George's trip from the jungle was in a Dole fruit box, very clearly, and the man with the yellow hat drove a Volkswagen car. Nothing else had a brand on it, but it was so clearly product placement in an unnecessary way. It was just like, oh, come on. So there's financial benefits to both sides. The licensee is saying, there's a marginal increase in sales to be associated with this. We could sell generic fruit snacks. We could just come up with our own characters, think about a company like Kellogg's. They've created mostly their own characters, and they've animated them over the years, and, you know, then they take the word sugar out of the names of the cereals because, you know, sugar Frosted Flakes become Frosted Flakes. Sugar Corn Pops, they were. sugar smacks become something else because that's bad. It's all brandy. But sometimes they create their own characters, but sometimes they latch on because they say, okay, we project a marginal increase of sales, and so we will pay a license fee that's somewhere between what we're making now and what we think we're going to make. So is the licensor going to really care about how profitable? Does the licensor want its license fees to be based on the success of the deal? If you're Flintstones or Disney or whomever, and the licensee comes to you and says, we think we're going to make an extra $1 million in the next quarter by working with you. And if we do, we'll pay you half. We'll pay you half of all of our profits. And we say, we think we're going to make $1 million. That's going to be a $500,000 deal for you. Any red flags going up? Count lawyers for licensors when the licensee says that to you? What's the problem with that? What?
You don't handle the accounting.
That's already the second order problem, right? Calculating profits, but that presumes what? That there were any, right? The licensor, who's not in any control of how these things are marketed, whatever the retailer price, the wholesale pricing, none of this. The licensor does not want to be held to a percentage of profits because it doesn't care. It wants what it wants. But of course, the licensee doesn't want to be held to a fixed fee because it doesn't know if it's going to be worth it. So that's when you start being creative in the negotiating. We're going to get to negotiating a little bit later in the semester. But you start thinking about, okay, one issue is compensation. How is it calculated? How much can the licensee make the argument successfully? Look, it's not just about license fees, intellectual property owner. We're providing you with, quote unquote, free advertising. The Allendale, gee, Disney lawyers, why are you complaining? These oddly painted Disney characters with human noses, they represent free advertising for your theme park 100 miles away. Why are you bothering us? It's not always a very convincing argument. But to a certain extent, it is. It is. And it's not just about, I mean, there are all sorts of interesting things. If you have a character, yes. But sometimes it's a distribution deal. One of the projects I worked on about 3-4 years into my career that was so much fun. Well, maybe a little later than that. Was something called Juno Online Services. Anyone ever use Juno.com, hear of it? Still have parents or old people who are still using it, know what it was? Juno was the first free email service launched you remember that?
Yeah. Wasn't there three of them that
competed? Eventually they all merged, but Juno was the first. I think United Online was another one that came out. I mean, this was at a point where we were still all paying per minute to connect to the whatever online service. And here came Juno, which was actually the brainchild of David E. Shaw, the hedge fund guru, who said, there's a market in free email services supported by advertising. So I'm going to dedicate a floor of my hedge fund office on 45th Street. I'm going to hire a whole bunch of smart people, get them lots of Jolt Cola, and yes, the cans were there. And we're going to create this product, and then we're going to sell it. And they're going to sell it to advertisers. there was a technical challenge, because how do you get the advertisements when the connections are so slow? They were really clever. I mean, the technology behind it, where essentially as you were reading your email, it was slowly, slowly sending you the next ads. So that the next time you went on, there was a new set of ads. You didn't have to wait for them to download. But it was free of charge anywhere in the country. Obviously, it wasn't free for Juno to provide. They had to pay for all the telephone connections and the data stuff. So they went to advertisers and they said, hey, advertisers, here's a great platform. But what was really creative, and the part that I got to work on, all this, none of this is confidential, the deals were there. They said to advertisers, not just, hey, advertisers, they went to advertisers with an audience. And they said, this is a great thing for you to give to your audience. Hey, record company, we're going to have you distribute our software on a CD with your music. And your ads are going to be part of this. It'll be co-branded. So you're paying us to advertise, maybe. I mean, there was all sorts of ways of doing that. We're using your distribution network. You're getting advertisements. And you're providing your music purchasers with free email service. So really creative. And all of that was about licensing and licensing back and leveraging the strengths of each company well beyond pay us to advertise here. That's easy. Just like pay us to license our stuff is easy. It's the creative things. Like the not just putting a character on, but the prizes you give, the commercials, promoting the movie that's coming out from the characters. That's the deal that you strike. And you as the lawyer, you might think your job is not to figure out the creative business stuff. But if you do your job right, it sure is, at least to contribute to that, to be thinking about it, because you may come up with a negotiation point where they say, you're not offering us enough money, or you're not giving us enough, whatever. You're asking too much. Then you got to be creative. And you go back to your client and say, well, what about this? What if we work it out this way? What if we shift that risk? They want us to only be paid if they get profits. That makes sense for them. We're not in control. We don't want that. But they're sticking on it. How do you balance? Just think creatively, top of your heads. How do you find a mid-ground between those two? Pay us all of it, we'll pay you if we profit. Where's the middle ground? Creative lawyers. What do you propose if you're representing one side or the other? You've got that divide. How do you breach? How do you bridge that gap?
Small upfront fee, and you don't get a percentage until you hit a certain benchmark.
Being creative. Hybridize. We want something up front, yes. But then we will take a share of participation. Then you get into the accounting issues. That's when it gets kind of complicated. Back to the kinds of things you want to think about. When you're representing the licensor, the character's owners, besides getting paid, what else do they have to worry about? What other things are the big risks for them to in agreeing to putting their characters on these products?
Not granting over too many rights.
What does that mean? What's the risk? If they're getting paid, what do they matter? What does it matter?
Usually they need too much of their right.
Why not?
They may need to
profit
more.
How?
By licensing it to someone else for another.
That's the answer. Thank you. I knew it was in there somewhere. You're right. Your instinct is a good one. Don't give away more than you have to. What was bothering David Gerald? He was willing to share his writing with to be evaluated. that grant, he was probably willing to share the words in his personal statement, his clever application. But the defined term application is likely including the writing sample, and that went too far. Because he had other ways, either he didn't have it to grant, or he had other ways to profit besides maybe winning a train trip. So your client doesn't want to give away too much. What else? Even focusing on this particular deal, what else is your client could be concerned about?
Quality control?
Yes, tell me about that. It's a toothbrush, and the head pops off, and there's a sharp screw. Right. So that is a concern. How do you deal with it as counsel to licensor? Periodic audits are usually more useful because you're not in that business. Would you know, walking through the food production plant, whether they're, you know, putting their fingers in the wrong pots of goo or whatever? That's probably not the right mechanism. How do you deal with it?
That you want them to comply with applicable laws, like with food, I guess.
So one thing is you want to make sure they're complying with applicable law. That's a good one. Yeah. Of course, they're supposed to anyway. So that's a nice commitment, but if they don't, you're going to be in line behind the regulators and all the parents of the dead kids, God forbid, right? Breach of contract is going to be the least of their worries. So how else can you address it?
Right, approval for any advertisement or whatever it uses.
So it's not just the product quality, it's the use of the characters overall. Right. You know, what is the commercial? So Post wants to do Fruity Pebbles, they want to have a Fred and Barney commercial, and they want to do their own animators. Are the voices going to sound right? Are there going to be motors in the cars or something equally horrific if you're a Flintstones person? Are they going to get it right? Because it could impact on the product. What else? How else can you, the licensor, your client, deal with risks for products it doesn't control? How do companies deal with risks generally?
Can you revoke the license if they don't comply?
Well, so more contract terms. So you don't want to make it irrevocable. And maybe that's, and there are a lot of reasons why you want to sort of take a stop and look and renegotiate. Why do you put in a term with a right to renew? Because it may not make sense for either side. There may be a better deal out there, or maybe just a really bad relationship, and you just want it, because contracts, you want to deal with the what ifs. So you put in either a right to revoke, or you put in a right to sort of reconsider. Do we want to renew or not? It's not working out, we're not real happy, my kids don't like your product, whatever it is. But how do businesses sort of step back a bit? One way is a contractual indemnity clause, right? If licensee screws up and licensor gets sued, yeah, then you could do some indemnification. But that assumes that the company that caused the problem has money in the bank left to pay for it. Indemnity provisions are very nice, and we'll take a look at indemnification, but...
A
force majeure is entirely the opposite. What a force majeure clause says is, if there's something out of our control, we're not liable for it. That reduces protection. It doesn't increase protection. How do companies manage risks? How do they manage the risks of their own products, or of people falling in their buildings, or of floods or fires or internet hacking?
Insurance.
Part of your job as a lawyer, as a risk manager, that's what we are, is to counsel your client about its insurance. Dear client, you're a cartoon company, you have cartoon company insurance. You're now putting your intellectual property on a cereal box. Does your insurance cover any liability for choking on your product? Or the kid takes 106 vitamins, God forbid. So your insurance, but where else does insurance come up? Who else might need insurance to, for example, back up an indemnity clause. Third-party beneficiary is the term. So, right, or additional insured.
Yeah. But insurance doesn't help you with, I guess, the goodwill of your brand if something goes wrong.
No, it doesn't.
Amount, but if seven SpongeBob DVD players burn down houses.
No. So it's some. So this is all, none of these is going to be the cure-all. Getting enough money to make the deal worth doing, that takes care of some of the risk. Your client's own insurance. Mandating and then making sure it happens, insurance on the other side. Quality control, product samples, all of the above, all of these things, doing due diligence. Is this a company that my client wants to do business with? What's their history? What's their regulatory history? All of that stuff, it's a layered approach to thinking about those risks in order to maximize the benefits. Did you want to add something? Okay, that's right. That's if there's a problem. And thank you for bringing that up. But we're not necessarily, right, if you're in different places and you want to use the courts, you have to think about where you're going to have to go to court. But let's sort of, again, think about the substance of this. So you've got issues of product quality. You've got issues of money. What other issues?
Well, if you're not going to give me exclusivity as the licensee, I don't want you to necessarily give it to my top competitors or something like that.
Right, okay, so now we're taking from the other side. So if you're representing the licensor and you anticipate that challenge, what do you do about it? Because you're right. That is clearly a concern of the licensee. Either you, one of two things, you volunteer or you agree to not working with competitors, or at least you counsel your client and say, look, they're going to want to be exclusive in this category. Is that okay with you? And if it is, how much are we losing? Not all categories could do across different companies. But for example, let's think of video game platforms. It's entirely possible that a licensor, could either be on one game platform or lots of game platforms. Both are possible. How those deals get struck has a lot to do with how much the licensee is willing to pay for the privilege of being exclusive. Right? So you're counseling your client, the licensor, they're going to want exclusivity. You're going to need to say to them, you want exclusivity? It's going to cost you. You pay us less, we'll go on your competitors' platforms. That's a business deal. So you think about the integrity of the licensed product, its reputation, the financial issues, the opportunities gained and lost. All of these things come into the key provisions. There's a lobby forum clause, force majeure, termination rights, indemnification even. Those are fairly standardized. But there are some things that are unique to a licensing deal. And so what I'd like you to do for next class, just these four key provisions, as fleshed out as you're able to, feel free to use outside examples. But don't use them too exactly, because I can Google a phrase in quotation marks as easily as anybody else. Adapt. Use multiple ones. Use your own words. And then tell me the other key provisions, not only what they are, but the basics, like an insurance thing, that you think would be most important. Here you're representing the licensee. It's the other side. So I really would like to see what you come up with. Questions? All right, have a good night. Long enough to answer the question.